As we had covered yesterday, as we'll continue on from that. But what I was going to make is the announcement. So I updated the web page with just a link to DV documentation. And one minor update to the project handout, if you've printed it already, it doesn't matter. It's just that the recommendation, so when you start modifying the 2D wave equation for the Tucholsky equation, it was recommended that you use the recommended parameters, and it was 32 points in R by 16 points in theta. Well, so this I've just updated to 64 points in R. It just turns out that the Tucholsky equation, in particular near the horizon, is marginally unstable for for low resolutions. It is unstable, and so you have to be sufficiently. You need a certain level of resolution to get into the regime where things are stable. So starting at 64 by 16 should be fine.
Why do we go 0 to pi instead of 0 to 2 pi in theta? That's
just the axis symmetry. So think, so this is r, this is phi, and then this is theta. So we could go 0 to 2 pi, but because of the azimuthal symmetry, it's exactly the same. So
okay.
We just go 0 to pi. Okay, so today we're going to sort of finish up the generalized harmonic form and do a little bit of the gravitational wave stuff. So where we had gotten yesterday is we took the Einstein field equations. We said, let's just take this definition, so the definition of these source functions in terms of a scalar wave operator acting on the space-time coordinates. We took the symmetric derivative of this and noticed that it contained the terms or what that function was exactly the set of terms in the Einstein equations that destroyed the hyperbolicity of the system. Well, not destroyed it. I mean, Einstein equations don't have any character, but there's a hyperbolic part plus some other parts, and these other parts are essentially encoded in this symmetric gradient of these source functions. So now the trick with harmonic coordinates is we're going to promote these to sort of independent functions. So we're going to sort of ignore the fact for the moment that this is a definition. We're going to treat these as independent functions. So now to do so, we also then have to close the system, we have to specify additional equations, and since we want to think of this as a hyperbolic Cauchy evolution, we want evolution equations for these source functions. So we need to specify evolution equations for H. Let's just write it. This is some differential operator. So we've got a set of four conditions. I'll just call it. Right, so a set of four additional equations that we need to specify to close the system. So for example, in one choice would just be, well, let's choose harmonic. That will be the sample choice. So now thinking of this system of equations as an initial boundary value problem, we have the metric for the initial data, at least from a purely mathematical point of view. If you sort of gave this system of equations to a mathematician and say, well, what do you need for a well-posed initial boundary value problem? For initial data, you want the metric at some time over all the spatial coordinates. You want the first derivative. You know, at t equals 0, the final space. And then you also need the same thing for these source functions you want. And its first time derivative. So we haven't really specified what class of functions we might allow, but let's just also say that these are going to satisfy up to it's going to be a second order partial differential equation in general. So we'll need the values and their first time derivatives at x equals 0. So given this, you can sort of analyze the structure of these equations, and you can say that you're going to get a unique solution. So it's a well-posed system of equations. But the problem is we're really not interested in solutions to this general, now expanded system of equations. We want to solve the Einstein equation. So we want solutions that satisfy this constraint. And so the first the first question that should come to mind is, well, is this really a trick or is it just something stupid? Have we just now expanded the system of equations and now we're going to generate solutions that we're not interested in? And it turns out that, at least analytically, it's not. And let's sort of draw graphically. So we've, in terms of, we've got a set of, so think of it in phase space, you know, 10 independent components. For each, the value of the field and its derivative, so 10, 10, 4, and 4. So 28 independent components. So in some sort of some loose sense of the word, we've got like this, you know, 28-dimensional vector space, and evolution is going to be a trajectory through this phase space. Right, so this is not a very precise picture, but so let's say here is one of the variables, here's another one, g dot, here's other. So we've got this higher dimensional phase space, initial conditions, so we pick some starting initial conditions, and then we're going to evolve, so we're going to have some trajectory through the phase space. And at a first glance, we can arbitrarily choose all of these, and we'll be able to find a solution. But in this phase space, we're not interested in all the solutions. We're interested in the subset that satisfy the constraint. So we're interested in the subset of solutions that satisfy C alpha equals zero, where we're defining this constraint to be. Okay, so you can imagine, so now there's some subspace in this higher dimensional phase space. And so if we're on a point in this subspace, a trajectory that's in this subspace satisfies the Einstein equations. And so this is the Einstein field equations. So this set of conditions in addition to this constraint. Actually, I've defined this to be minus that. Yeah.
Do we identify trajectories which differ only by the choice of H to be different physical solutions?
So that's an interesting question. Right. So the thing is, so in this formalism here, we're going to be thinking of these H's as gauge fields. But it's not necessarily, and in some sense, there's a little bit of arbitrariness to that, right? So you can't entirely disentangle the gauge fields from the metric.
Right.
Just like with the ADM formalism, you think of lapse and shift as your gauge fields, but it's not as simple as saying, okay, so given a spatial metric H, is it the same physical metric if you just have different lapse and shifts? And it's not necessarily going to be the same. So in general, you've got 4 degrees of freedom, and here we sort of want to think of them as being encoded in the H, but it's a little bit more complicated than saying, first from the point of view of an initial value boundary problem, if you start with G's and G dots and H dot, and you evolve in time with now different choices for your evolution equations for H. In theory, yeah, you should get the same space-time, but it won't necessarily be the G's that you get might look different because you're going to be in different coordinate systems. But
sorry. Scalar quantities, they don't
change.
I mean, observables.
Yeah. So. And they also don't depend on G's, right? So, I mean, if you define appropriate observable quantities, it doesn't matter what G is in that particular coordinate system or that particular gauge, nor what H is. You should get the same scalars at the end of the day. This is perhaps said another way. So you start with the same physical initial conditions. If you can sort of somehow quantify that, If you change your gauge at late times, if you compare what g's you get at the at that late time compared with a different gauge, they'll look different. But that's just because you're in a different coordinate system. But if you compute the same physical observable, you'll get the same number. Okay, so the question in here is, well, of course, if we start with a solution that doesn't satisfy the Einstein equation, if we start with a point which is not consistent with the Einstein equation, well, of course, I mean, that's already, we're already sort of not where we want to be. So the question is really, if we start with initial condition that is consistent with the Einstein equation, so consistent with this condition, in particular, what it's going to have to be, because it's not just that we use this condition in the Einstein equations, we use its gradient. So consistent initial conditions would be so we want to start with C alpha equal to 0 and its first time derivative equal to 0. So we start with We don't freely specify these 28 fields. We specify them subject to the to these constraints that c is equal to 0 and the first time derivative is 0. So we start on this thing, and then we say, then we want to evolve these equations with this evolution system. Are they going to stay on this constraint manifold? Are they going to sort of stay in the surface and be a consistent solution to the field equations, or are they going to deviate away from it? So sort of depending perhaps on what gauge functions you have. And it turns out analytically that if you satisfy this condition and you make sure that this is satisfied at the boundary for all times, then the solution will always stay on the constraint manifold. And it's sort of a property of the Bianchi identities. Let me just first... Okay. Let me just show you how these constraints relate to the usual ADM Hamiltonian momentum constraints. Because one, if you just look at this the structure of these equations, we'll say, well, how do you specify self-consistent data? Do you want to like solve this equation? It turns out this, if you just expand this in terms of, you know, the 1 over root g, you know, g alpha beta, it's not a nice system of equations. It's not very obvious what are your freely specifiable quantities and what are your gauge quantities. And the ADM formula does a nice way of separating that out. You know, you've got your lapse and your shift is your gauge. And I don't know if Matt covered the York-Lichnerowitz initial data methodology. And then that's sort of going one step further within the ADM formalism to identify on your initial slice what you can freely specify and what then... And in such a way that you get a nice system of equations, essentially a set of elliptic equations. So what's going to be nice with... So this at the first glance looks like a mess, but it turns out that this is essentially exactly your usual ADM constraints. And so a nice way of providing initial data is just solve the ADM constraint equations, and then once you've got the lapse and the shift and the spatial metric and the first time derivatives, you can then reconstruct this. So these are our constraints. I'm going to write it. So as I mentioned, that this quantity isn't strictly speaking a vector by the way that it transforms it. We can treat it as a vector if we then say, well, it's got different transformation properties. So it transforms like the trace of a Christoffel symbol. So what I'm saying here is that this thing, we're just defining it to be, right? So and the same with the raising and lower operators. So we're going to use all the tensor notation on these quantities, and it's perfectly valid to do so. You just have to notice that this isn't the traditional tensor under coordinate transformations. So these are the constraints. So the traditional sort of ADM constraints are the time something components of the metric. So the time of the field equation. So the time component of the field equations gives you the Hamiltonian constraint. The time-space components gives you the momentum constraints, and sort of a way to write it in a sort of a gauge invariant manner is to take a normal vector. So we have our t equals constant surface. So n alpha is the a unit time-like normal vector. To this t equals constant surface. And so we'll define the time-time component to be just, the Einstein tensor dot nn, space-time with dot nh, and h is that projection, or this. So I think Matt introduced these quantities in the first week, so this was the projection tensor. So the traditional ADM constraints, you can write them in terms of some, this notion of time. So just the Einstein tensor. And now subtract, taking the stress tensor to the left-hand side if we have matter. So this is zero for the Einstein equations. And you get the constraints by just inner multiplying it with one time vector. So this, now we get a vector. I'm going to call it m sub alpha. So it turns out so m alpha, n alpha is just, that has to be zero. This is a Hamiltonian constraint. And m alpha, if you project it now onto the spatial hypersurface, so this is a set of three non-trivial conditions. These are the momentum constraints. So what we want to get at now is what's the relationship between the traditional constraints and these harmonic constraints? And if it's just a sort of an exercise in tensor algebra, and you can show that it's the following. Let me just go up here. Let's see if you want to go through this. You can show that so in some sense, sort of what this is, so it, I mean, various gradients. I mean, this is going to contain, if you take the symmetric thing, it's going to take essentially sort of a time derivative of these constraints plus spatial derivatives plus a trace term. So it's not, it's, I mean, it's a relatively simple relationship at the end of the day. And of course, the nice thing that you can see here is if, you know, if C is zero for all time, that can only be true if these constraints are satisfied, then you satisfy these and vice versa.
If H is the vector dependent on T, you should force also the constraints satisfied at each time, right? So the derivative of C is zero.
If H is independent of...
Is dependent on T.
T,
yeah. Should enforce that C alpha dot,
yeah,
is zero.
Right, so the if this is dependent on time.
Yeah, suppose it's dependent.
Yeah.
Now you want that this constraint is satisfied at each time.
Yeah.
So you enforce that during the evolution this is true. So that the time derivative of that is zero.
Yeah.
But in this case, H alpha is T dependent, right?
Yeah, in general, it will be T dependent. But then, if so, there is so regardless of whether it's, if in some sense, if this is T dependent, this quantity better have the same t dependence for all time. Right? So, and in general, this is going to be time dependent. This better be zero. This better be time independent, but it's going to have to be so in a way which satisfies us this constraint. We'll sort of see, at least formally, how this happens analytically. So if you start with C and C dot equal to zero, then C dot will be zero for all time. Okay, but so it's with this thing, we're just relating the C's to the initial constraints. So it's sort of demonstrating that if you solve these, then, well, so this for instance is, so we wanted to say C and C dot is equal to zero. This is going to contain a C dot term. So it's perhaps not quite a trivial relationship. You can, you know, if you sort of integrated this, you might have a constant of integration, but I don't think it's, from this relationship, it's consider, is it like the practical way of specifying initial conditions is not necessarily by picking a subset of G's and H's and then trying to integrate these equations such that that is equal to zero. Well, I mean, that's positive. There are probably ways of doing that, but if you look at the structure of this equation or its time derivative, it's not a nice system of equations. It's not, it will probably be a parabolic type equation, but you have to sort of integrate on your initial slice, which would be a bit of a pain. But they're very nice ways of solving these constraints with this York-Lichnerowitz style decomposition. And this says, well, if you solve them, then you don't even have to worry about explicitly enforcing it. It will be enforced because of this relationship. So, okay, so now the next, again, so I'm not going to go through the details of how to derive it, but now what we can do is we can derive a propagation, sort of an evolution equation, for these constraints that just depend on the geometry. Essentially use the Bianchi identities and some other tensor algebra. That you can show that regardless of your choice of source functions, that the constraint equations will satisfy the following equations. So in some sense, therefore, this is sort of a geometric identity. This does not depend. It doesn't depend on choice of H. That this quantity satisfies an inhomogeneous wave equation with the following source term. So what this equation implies is if we choose initial conditions that are consistent with the constraint, so that C is zero at T equals zero and C dot is zero, then this will be zero for all time because this is just the wave equation. So this says this propagates the constraints. If we start with C equals zero on the initial surface, C dot is zero, and we choose boundary conditions where we don't sort of feed non-zero C's into the boundaries, then the unique solution is C equals zero for all time. And so, and let's say, impose boundary conditions such that, and so C alpha is zero on the boundary of the domain. So this is what we're after, at least at the mathematical level. We've sort of done this little trick where we promoted this to an independent function so that we have a nice system of hyperbolic equations for the metric. But in doing so, we've introduced these additional set of differential equations, which are in principle arbitrary. But we don't want to solve this expanded system. We still want solutions to the Einstein equations. And what this identity tells us, well, we can make sure that we do have a solution to the Einstein equations. In other words, C equals zero for all time. If we choose that C and C dot are zero, plus impose appropriate boundary conditions such that that is true for all time. Now, this is actually rather non-trivial, because if you think about it, nowhere in this evolution system do the C's appear. So we can't just say, well, let C equal 0 on the boundary. Somehow, imposing C equals 0 on the boundary means we have to choose boundary conditions on the fundamental variables, which are the G's and the H's, such that C is equal to 0. And that's not an easy task in general. I mean, it's easy in certain restricted situations, or if, for example, if you went to compactify to spatial infinity, such you know that the metric is Minkowski, and you know Minkowski spacetime, you know, at spatial infinity, that is a solution to the field equations. But if you were in a finite volume, it will usually not be easy to impose such boundary conditions. But at least formally, this at the analytic level, this shows that you can solve the expanded subsystem subject to these initial conditions and get a solution to the field equations. Okay, so that's, you know, that's fairly nice. And in fact, I mean, there's similar properties for the usual ADM equations, right? So with the ADM equations, if you want to do an evolution, it's weakly hyperbolic, but if you could think of it as at the analytic level, if you solve these at the initial time and then use the evolution equation from the ADM, then analytically you can show that these are satisfied for all time. But now the problem numerically is, even if we guarantee that this is zero and the first time derivative is zero at our initial slice, now we evolve this, but now a discrete version, a discretized version of this. So we now discretize these equations. So what we'll really be solving is, we sort of do a Richardson expansion. You can sort of think of it at the continuum level as solving this system of equations, but now, say, a second-order accurate scheme with your mesh spacing H. Now you're going to have, analytically, some truncation error terms and an infinite series of these. So numerically, if you want to sort of rewrite the problem as a continuum system of differential equations, you've got this expanded system of equations, and this is presumably very, very small. So you're going to the solutions that you're going to get are presumably a decent approximation to the field equations. However, the problem is that you'll never be able to satisfy this exactly. In other words, this condition can only be derived if these are zero. So in general, so you can start with initial conditions where this is exactly zero, but there are going to be some truncation error sources that act on this. So in a numerical evolution, well, you'll start with this condition, and you'll start evolving on the constraint manifold, but there's nothing that says that you're not going to start deviating away from it. And in general, that's not necessarily a problem. We know for any equations that we solve numerically, we've always got these terms. The question is only, how small do these remain relative to the solution? And so with the convergence testing and the Richardson expansion, you can place rigorous error bars on your numerical simulations. You can bound these. And so the only question is, well, how fast do these grow? And in particular, if they grow very rapidly and if they grow exponentially in time, that could be a problem. And one sort of, just to imagine how easy it is to get exponential growth in this situation. So we start with, we have a point on the manifold. We get a little bit of a truncation error induced deviation. Say, well, okay, now we're this far off the constrained manifold. Now we take another time step. How much is this typically going to grow by? Well, it's not difficult to sort of imagine that the amount of growth is going to be proportional to how far you're away from the constraint manifold. And if you have, if you have something where, the C dot is proportional to C, you're naturally going to get an exponential. And so I think this is sort of the problem that plagues all of these free evolution schemes for the Einstein equations. All of them, there is this expanded system of it. There is sort of this expanded solution space because you cannot simultaneously satisfy the constraints and the evolution equations. And what typically happens in all of these is you have exponentially growing modes. And so, yes, that's not a numerical instability. It's really just your truncation error thing. But if this thing is growing exponentially in time, at some point, it's going to dominate. Even if this is very, very small, it's going to dominate the solution. So the cure with generalized harmonic is, so this was, this idea goes back a while, several years. You know, Luis did some stuff with that. And this particular flavor of this solution is from Carsten Gundlach. And the idea is, okay, we have this, we want these solutions, but we've got an equation that tells us how this system evolves even if we're not on the solution space. So we can really modify the equations here however we want, right? So we can, so let's try to change things when we're off the constraint manifold such that we don't get exponentially growing modes. You know, perhaps they just grow linearly with time, perhaps they don't grow, perhaps even better, they're exponentially decaying solutions. And the trick here is, so we take these things and we can add any homogeneous function of the constraints to these equations. So here we can add any function f of c as long as, you know, when we set c equal to 0. So on this, the subspace that satisfy the Einstein equations, this is 0. So the second trick, you know, to getting to a stable evolution after doing this harmonic trick is to add 0 to the field equations, at least at the 0 such that this subspace isn't modified, but the equations change when you go off this constraint manifold. I'm just going to show you the form that Carsten Gundlach suggested. And they were able to prove that what this does, if you start in the region, so let's say this is Minkowski space. So if you start with a small perturbation from Minkowski space, what this function that they suggested does is all perturbations, all deviations off the constraint manifold exponentially decay. At least all finite wavelength perturbations exponentially decay. And there's no proof in general that this is going to work when you're in different classes of solutions. I think it's just empirically for binary black holes, which is sort of one of the more interesting solutions that people have been interested in. I think really the only one that people have systematically looked at with this constraint damping, it actually does work. So we're going to... That's the second trick. I think there's a word in German for this. The translation is you add a nutritious zero to the equations. I'm probably spelling it wrong. But so we're going to add zero to the equations. In particular, the set of terms that we're going to add is as follows. So there's a single constant that you can choose. You can make this some function of space-time. But this, let's just call this a constant, okay, some constant. And it's this particular function of the constraints. So there's no gradients. It's just the symmetric product of the normal vector and the constraints. And then this is a contraction with the normal and the constraints. So n is just a normal vector. The usual one, so t equals constant surface. And actually, so in the original proposal, this was any vector, any time-like vector. For lack of any better choices, people have only ever considered this to be the unit hypersurface normal vector, but in principle this could be any vector. So you can see we're adding, for solutions to the Einstein equations where C is equal to zero, we're adding zero to the equation. So any solution to the Einstein's equations are a solution to these new equations. And this is also sometimes called constraint damping. And so we add these constraint damping terms that, at least in general, we hope convert the things from exponentially growing to exponentially damping. In particular, what you can show, this is again the same identity that we've got to see. How do these C's propagate? And now we see, well, how do these terms modify the propagation of these C's and the new propagation equation? It's, again, it's a homogeneous wave equation. So this is what we had before. But now there are these extra terms. And at least one of the terms sort of looks like a damping term you'd add to a wave equation. So you know, if you have like a damped wave equation, and so this covariant language would look something like this. You have some constant k, then you'll have the gradient of the field in the time direction. So it would be something like this. So this is sort of a damped, you know. So if this is your time-like direction, so you add a term that's proportional to the time derivative of the field with a positive constant, it becomes a damped wave equation. So you can play around this in just Minkowski space, and you'll see you'll get exponentially damped solutions. So you can sort of see that, at least to this term, though, one of the terms in this equation, when you expand out this, when you symmetrize it, does contain a damping term. So you can sort of imagine that this is going to sort of do what you want. Unfortunately, why a proof is lacking in the general case is because you have to symmetrize. It's not that you have to symmetrize. Just from this set of terms, this is an identity. This is what comes out as a propagation equation. And so you also get a term that's the gradient of this normal vector term. So it's because of this extra term that it's not easy to prove that this is a damped wave equation in general. But I think you can sort of just by... seeing that, you know, okay, it might actually work like how you'd expect. And you can sort of see why the proof in perturbations about Minkowski space works, because if you start with Minkowski space to linear order, this is just going to be a constant. This is just one in the time-like direction. So this first term vanishes for perturbations about Minkowski space, and then you really do get a damped wave equation. Okay, any questions? Yeah. Yeah, it's Karsten Gundlach and a couple of others, I forget. I think this is mostly his idea, but on the paper as well, it's Ian Hinder and Jose Maria.
Martin
Garcia. Yeah, that. Ian Hinder and Jose. Jose, so it's something around 2005 or 6 that the paper is up there. So as of today, there are sort of two formalisms that sort of empirically work for binary black holes. One is this generalized harmonic with constraint damping. And this, perhaps, you know, on a formal, from a formal mathematical way, I think this is on the slide. You can sort of imagine why this might work. You know, we've got manifestly hyperbolic equations, and we've added terms that do sort of have a slightly damping term. I think with the BSSN form, again, empirically it works. And I'm not quite sure if there's as nice of a formal mathematical understanding as to why it works. I think this sort of hand-waving argument, and like, why do all the other symmetric hyperbolic forms not work? And, in all of those, there have also been suggestions of adding, you know, functions of the constraints to those equations with adjustable parameters. I think a problem with all of those other formalisms is that there are many more constraints that are introduced other than just the Einstein constraints. And if you can just from this argument, you know, what typical type of growth would you expect? You know, exponentially such a natural thing to get when you say, well, the growth might be proportional to how far you're away from the manifold, you naturally get exponential solutions. So you can imagine that it would be a very tricky issue to stabilize those formalisms in the same way. And at least, you know, aesthetically, what I think is nice about this is that you've really got the minimum possible number of constraints that you can have in the Einstein equations. We haven't introduced any auxiliary variables, and you really can't get rid of these fundamental constraints. Okay, so now so perhaps taking a step, going back to the first lecture where I wanted to show you about the gravitational waves, let's do that. And it's very trivial to start with this form. So the linearized Einstein equations in a harmonic gauge, and then we're going to also impose transverse traceless gauge. So that's sort of the standard way in which gravitational wave perturbations are written. Equations. We want to look at gravitational waves in the TT gauge, transverse. And as I mentioned in the first lecture, one reason why you really have to do something like this is there's no unambiguous notion of what a gravitational wave is in general relativity. And it's really only when we get very, very far from the source, where we know in approximately a Minkowski space-time, we can define in some unambiguous way, and in particular, what LIGO will see, because we're pretty much in Minkowski space-time. So we can sort of unambiguously define what a gravitational wave is. So we can assume that we have, just say, our metric is equal to Minkowski space-time plus a small perturbation. We're just going to use Cartesian coordinates. And we're going to, and the assumption here, so this is a small perturbation. So we're immediately then assuming that not only sort of in some kind of a geometric sense is this small, but we've also chosen coordinates where in these coordinates this is small. Because you could always take Minkowski space-time and do some coordinate transformation where these are arbitrarily large numbers. So we're assuming we're in sort of a nice gauge where this perturbation is really small compared to eta. Then we're going to take this, we're going to substitute it into the field equations, and we're going to restrict, say, vacuum. We're going to choose harmonics, so we're going to set H equal to 0, and we're not going to worry about any so let's just say take vacuum, choose harmonic gauge. And we're doing this analytically, so let's not worry about the constraint damping terms. Substitute this into the field equations and keep only terms to leading order in H in the perturbation. So a nice thing, if you only keep terms to leading order in H, you can raise and lower, you know, with a Minkowski metric, and in particular in terms of the coordinates, the upstairs and downstairs indices are exactly the same to leading order. And so if you do that, you can see, well, the H terms go away. This is gradient squared. The Minkowski's constant, so they're not going to have any gradients. But the only term that's going to come up here is an H squared term that's going to vanish, or gradients of H squared. These terms are nonlinear as well. And so you just immediately get that the perturbation satisfies a wave equation. Right, so what you get is that and your box is with respect to leading order, the Minkowski metric. So you just get that, you get a set of essentially 10 wave equations on the Minkowski background. Okay, so at a first glance, then you can say, okay, well, this is the structure of the linearized field equations. Well, there are 10 propagating degrees of freedom. This is a symmetric matrix. The general solution to this is any one of these can, you know, it'd be a wave equation. And yeah, that's true, but the thing is, we haven't yet completely fixed all of our gauge conditions. In particular, we can still have harmonic. Right. And so if we say, you know, we want a harmonic gauge, we can still satisfy harmonic gauge. We can sort of transform coordinates. We're going to find a new coordinate, which is, say, in this form. So we can write any function. So we can take our existing coordinates and add some set of four coordinate transformations. We can add these set of functions. And in terms of the new coordinates, we will still have harmonic. So this will be zero if these are harmonic functions. So we still have some freedom. We haven't used up all of our coordinate degrees in harmonic gauge, and so we still have the freedom to choose to essentially specify a particular gauge. And so the idea is to get down to the statement that, you know, there are really only two propagating degrees of freedom in GR. We want to completely use up all of our coordinate degrees of freedom. We want to make sure that we've completely fixed the gauge. Now, there's no unique way of doing it. The approach that we're going to do is this transverse traceless gauge, which sort of, that's perhaps the nicest way of showing the gravitational wave structure. But again, there's no unique way of doing it. But we just want to make sure that we aren't confusing sort of gauge modes with gravitational wave modes. So, we're not going to actually specifically find a particular coordinate transformation. I mean, we haven't even specified what this is. But you can show that in vacuum, sort of in the linearized regime, you can always find a set of these functions that will take you to transverse traceless gauge. And I think there's if you want to sort of see the details, in the Flanagan and Hughes reference that I had, it's on the archive. So they had a review article on gravitational waves in the appendix. They sort of prove that you can always go to transverse traceless gauge in vacuum. I've put the PDFs of the PowerPoint slides on the web page as well with where that reference is. Okay, so we still have gauge freedom left, and by sort of a number counting argument, we have, you know, four transformations, so we can still sort of do four things with this metric. I mean, incidentally, so this, an important point is, these are the Einstein field equations, linearized field equations, but we're inharmonic. So we can't, again, we can't choose these arbitrarily. They have to satisfy the harmonic condition. Right, so this, you know, subject, so this subject to box x alpha equals 0. And it's a pretty straightforward, you know, if you do plug in what box H is equal to 0 with respect to this matrix, it's really just that the divergence of this is 0. So this is vanishing divergence, sort of like a Lorentz type condition. Okay, so So the first thing that we're going to do is, in simplifying the gauge, we're going to demand that this be traceless. That's the first part of the transverse traceless. So we have four more gauge choices we can make. So one is we're going to choose that H is traceless. And then we're going to choose that the spatial components, the space-time components are zero. That's a zero. So let's see, so the T component we're going to call the zero index, and the spatial components xi, I is going to be 1, 2, 3. So the space-time components of the metric are zero. That's going to be, so let me write it over here. Let me see how. So at this stage, right, so we have H 0, 0, and it's symmetric, HX, so it's just 1, 1, 2, 2, 3, 3, etc. So this is still and so now we're going to choose that this is equal to 0, and we've chosen that the trace is equal to 0. So the sum of the diagonal elements is equal to 0. So now we've used up all of our coordinate degrees of freedom, and in addition, we have this condition. So the first thing that we can show that simplifies things even more. If we take now this condition and we look at the harmonic condition, so this plus harmonic. Well, first of all, the harmonic condition is just to the time component. So if we look at box T to linear order, it's just that so this is just the harmonic condition for the time coordinate. Now we've imposed that these are zero, right? So from this condition, these are zero, and so we get that the time component is a constant, right? The time derivative of this perturbation is zero. This is a combination of these two constraints, so we integrate this and this has to be a constant. So we're just further going to assume that infinitely far backwards in time, we didn't have any perturbation. So we start from Minkowski. So let's just choose this to be zero. Okay, so this gauge condition actually says that the time component of the metric perturbation is zero. So we now have this 3x3 matrix. That's also still has to satisfy this harmonic condition. Okay, so let's see if I, let me just write a summary of this. Okay, we put time. Yeah, we'll be finished in a couple of minutes, 5 minutes. Okay, so we have the Einstein field equations. This is zero. This is zero. The trace is zero. And then the harmonic gauge condition, in addition to these others, are that each of these have vanishing divergence. So this was harmonic plus, so this whole set of gauge, in addition to harmonic, it's called transverse traces. You'll see why it's transverse in a second. This is the harmonic gauge condition. And then these were, this is sort of the TT choices. So linearized field equations, transverse traces, harmonic, and this is also a consequence of transverse traces and harmonic. Okay. So the general solution to a wave equation and in Cartesian coordinates, we can use whatever solution method we want. The simplest is just to consider the sum of plane wave solutions. Because it's linear, I mean, there's no loss of generality of considering just a plane wave propagating in a particular direction. So let's just consider a plane wave propagating in the z direction. All right, so without loss of generality, consider a plane wave propagating in the z or I equals 3 direction. And then we can just superimpose all of these solutions for a general solution plus solutions in the x and the y direction. And so we know then that the solution for that case is just that hij is, this is a set of constant coefficients. So you have a 3x3 matrix of constant coefficients. And I'm just going to write the plane wave here. So e to the I, whatever, kx minus omega t, it's just a function of t minus z. So this is a wave propagating in the plus z direction at the speed of light. So this is the solution. However, this solution is still subject to all of these constraints. We cannot freely specify these coefficients. They are subject to these constraints. So let's first see what this harmonic condition tells us with the solution. So if we take this solution and plug it into this harmonic condition, this is just acting on the spatial components. So the only gradient that's going to appear here is the z gradient. So this is the only dependence in this solution. So if you do it, you'll get that. Right, so this is by minus, this prime is just dfd this times dfdz, which gives the minus sign. And you will get ajz equals 0. So what this says, since this is non-zero, all of these coefficients have to be 0. So for a wave that's traveling in the z direction, it says, so we have hij, so just the spatial components. So we can have hxx, hyy, sorry, xy, hyx, hyy. This says all the z components have to be 0. In other words, this represents a perturbation in the geometry. Remember, the full geometry is Minkowski plus this perturbation. So this is saying that in this, at least as represented in the TT gauge, a wave that travels in the z direction, there's no perturbation in the z direction in any of the metric components. And that's where the transverse part of this gauge comes up, is that the only perturbations are transverse to the direction of propagation. Right, so if it's in the z direction, this is the only way, the xy direction is the only possible way where we can have a perturbation. Now, putting in the final constraint that, so this is the harmonic constraint, but this has to be a traceless matrix. So this submatrix has to be this non. So it's also symmetric. So right. So we have a symmetric 2x2 traceless matrix, and you can generally write. So what we're left, so we're left with a 2x2 symmetric traceless matrix I'll call it A capital IJ. So capital I and J is just going to be running over X and Y, so 1 and 2. And any 2 by 2 symmetric traceless matrix, you can write as a linear superposition in terms of these basis vectors. So right. So there are only 2 degrees of freedom left in this 2 by 2 matrix, and we can compose it in terms of these sort of orthogonal matrices where these functions are A and B. And so what is traditionally done is we do this decomposition, and we call this the plus polarized component, and this one we call the cross polarized component. So specifically, okay, and here is the, right, so the solution is this constant coefficient set of matrices. I'm calling this H plus and H cross. So this is the general solution for a plane wave traveling in the z direction, or a plane wave with these constant coefficients. So if we have an arbitrary shaped wave, we just have a sum of these solutions, and then we can also add waves traveling in the x and y direction. But this sort of shows where we now come up with our 2 standard polarizations. And you can also see, you know, why this does this oscillatory stretching and squeezing. So if you imagine, let's just look at the plus polarized. You can show that if you do a rotation by 45 degrees, plus and plus will go to cross and vice versa. So let's just, you can see that, so our metric, if we just look at the plus polarized wave, is Minkowski. So in the x direction, we're going to have 1 plus h plus. Minus h plus dy squared plus dz squared. So, and sorry, and this function of t minus z. T minus z. But in any case, so whatever this is doing, you can see at one instant as this wave is passing, for example, if h plus happens to be positive, this is at a positive part of the phase, distance in x is going to be stretched, but at the same time, it's going to be shrunk in the y direction. And if this is a sinusoidal wave, that's going to oscillate back and forth. And so that's where you get this usual picture. So in the xy direction, you have a wave propagating in. If you have a sort of look at a ring of test particles, they will, you know, alternatively stretch and squeeze in these directions. And it's just exactly from this. And similar with if you want to look at the cross polarization. But that would then be, that's in the xy direction, as you can see there. And so that's just rotated by 45 degrees. So any questions? So one, like we probably won't have time to spend any on like the Newman-Penrose formalism and that stuff in class, but I sort of, in the notes, in the first page or two, there's sort of a little bit of a discussion of the Newman-Penrose formalism and also how it relates to H and H plus and H cross in an appropriate tetrad, in particular. You know, the psi 4 that I showed you in the animation, you know, that's just proportional to, you know, h plus double dot minus I h cross double dot. So it's a complex number. The real component is the plus polarization, the complex the cross, but with second time derivatives. And this thing is a very, it's easy to calculate this in a numerical code. You choose your tetrad, you assume that your metric is close to Minkowski, but you don't have to actually. So if you wanted to do this kind of thing in numerical code, you would have to extract the H's. So you'd have to, I mean, that would probably not be too challenging either, but this is a very nice way of doing it, and you immediately get the polarizations, at least to within quadrature. Okay, good. So tomorrow, I guess that's the last lecture, because Friday's vacation. So tomorrow, It'll be PowerPoint. I'll go describe Berger and Olliger adaptive mesh refinement. So it's not going to be as formula heavy, so it'll be easier to do it with PowerPoint. Okay, thank you.
One announcement. The Real Geophysical Cosmology Lecture today at 3:30.